That's good. Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here, and let's get on into it. Happy Sunday to you. It's a beautiful day here in Colorado. My son and I went out on a little hike this morning. I've been really wanting to be more physically active, period, and I also just have this goal that I've set for myself where I want to learn how to forage. In particular, my favorite mushroom, the Amanita muscaria mushroom, which right now is prime time at the beginning and at the end of summer is when the biggest flushes, and the end of summer is what a lot of people say is like the most potent and the most viable flushes that come out. And I haven't ever actually went out and looked for mushrooms before. And I did not see any Amanitas. Today was a little hot, it was a little dry, and I don't think I was in the right area. I went to an open space that's up north out of town called the Pineries. And while it is a beautiful pine forest, we've had a lot of forest fires that have also come out and decimated huge swaths of forest land near where I live. The biggest one was a couple years ago, and it was in Waldo Canyon. And this fire was scaring people because it was like only like a couple miles away from the nice, ritzy, you know, super nice part of town. And all these people were having to evacuate. It came up to like literally up to the highway in some areas. And so I noticed that a lot as I was walking through these today was a lot of these trees would still be alive, but like the bottom 10 feet of their bark would be caked in ash. They were black. And I've heard a lot of people say that since a lot of the fires have come through, this did seem to disturb some of the ability for these mushrooms to be able to grow. And where people used to see them, they don't show up anymore. My friend found a bunch of beautiful Amanita chrysoblema, which is particularly what I'm looking for. True Amanita muscaria does not grow in the United States. It is a European mushroom, but we have it used to be called the Amanita muscaria variant Gesoui, but Gesoui is now chrysoblema. And there are these reddish, yellowish, orangish mushrooms with white dots sometimes, whereas muscaria is usually that brilliant Christmas red, where some chrysoblema here will get that pigment, but there's just a lot more variation. And as I've discussed before, Amanita muscaria is a mycorrhizal mushroom, which mycorrhizal means that it forms these intense partnerships with trees. And that means that it's almost impossible to grow them, but people have figured out how to grow morels, and there's going to be a will. If there's a will, there's a way. However, you almost have to bring the tree inside your house or in fact, a piece of the forest inside the house, because a tree isn't going to survive very well on the inside of your house either, and it needs its dependent relationships. So mycorrhizal colonies form this relationship with their host trees, or the trees are their host mushrooms. And what will happen is that the plants themselves cannot get certain nutrients that they need, whereas their fungal partners have these chemical strategies that they use in order to break apart pieces of rocks and to get minerals and valuable things like phosphorus and magnesium and all these things that are needed by life, including the plant. And then the mushroom will then trade these useful minerals for sugars that the trees are able to photosynthesize. Now, this economy that forms from this means that mushrooms are trading sugars with trees and then moving these sugars through these systems. And it's fucking mystical and magical when I start to think of it. It's the wood wide web. And I just haven't gone out and put enough. In fact, today I think was the first time I've ever had any intentions of looking for mushrooms. And I had my son with me, and we're in an exclusively pine forest because most of these mycorrhizal colonies will form these relationships with particular types of trees. And so pines are very endemic to Colorado, and those are the ones that I'm usually hunting for, these pine forests, which is where I was. But I think it was just a little bit too social because there's a lot of people on the trail, and then literally 5 feet off the trail is like an electric fence that says private property. So you're like in this little tiny little like corridor of naturalness, which just sucks. But I enjoyed it. And about 5-10 minutes into our hike, Odin just points out some mushrooms, like, "Dad, there's some mushrooms." And I looked under, and there's these burnt, sort of reddish, brownish mushrooms, which I don't have a clear ID, but I did make a post on Reddit to try to figure something out. But I'm pretty sure there are these russulas, which are like a type of bow leaf. And I don't think I've ever found a mushroom outdoors before. And I felt very excited. It was thrilling. It was worth it, you know. And we went out and we continued to do about another mile and a half out. We're looking for this pond that supposedly was located in this open space. And we didn't quite get there. And Odin started getting tired, and I didn't want to burn him out. And so we turned around. So we spent about 2 hours hiking 3 miles, and we found 3 mushrooms. And felt pretty good. Feels like I succeeded today. Not that that's important. I've been reading through the Bhagavad Gita again, which the Bhagavad Gita is the book about Arjuna's conversation with Krishna in between the battle of, I'm not going to try to say what the battle is because I can't remember the fucking name, and it's that Indian shit. But basically one of the things that they discuss in the third chapter of the teachings is this idea of discipline. Whereas Krishna exclusively says that nobody ever throughout any time period has ever not been in action. We're always acting, we're always moving, we're always doing something. However, we do not have to eat the fruits of our action, because when we act, it creates this consequence, this karma. But the true idea is to not eat the fruit, to not consume our action. And what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to sacrifice that action. And to do that is to give the act away to a god, to your child, to some idea of something outside of yourself. And to have discipline in that action is to be able to accept success or failure as the same thing, because they're not different. To make the judgment about life and to say you've succeeded or to fail is to act without discipline and to eat the fruits of our labor, according to Krishna in this religious text. So I had that in my mind as I dolloped through the forest with my child. And I knew that yesterday when I decided I wanted to do this, that there was a risk here for me to become demoralized, especially if I found nothing. So I tried to, you know, think ahead, and I practiced that. And I had that conversation with myself about how even if I didn't find anything, it's still a success to be out in the forest. It's still going to be healthy and good for me. But it does not matter whether it's judged, honestly. And it was so good. I'm real happy to be able to spend my Sunday in such a nice way. Another nice new occurrence that's come into Odin and I's life is that we have adopted a kitten. He's sitting right over here on the bed. He's little and tiny, and he's mean. And I haven't had a baby animal in quite a while. And I've had some lessons that I have endearingly gleaned from my new relationship with this little being. And it's hysterical, really. So a lot of my purpose and reasoning for getting the kitten wasn't for myself. It wasn't inherently to have more pleasure in my life. It wasn't because I thought it would be fun. My primary goal was to give Shifu some camaraderie, because I know that she just sits home alone all day long in her closet, which is what she's doing now. And I just felt that if I got her another creature that she could relate to, which cats can relate the most to themselves, I would assume. And then I also wanted to get a second chance for Odin to have a bond with an animal, because Shifu's so weird and she's so unsocialized that I was hopeful that they would be able to really stick, you know? I'm not quite sure if it's succeeding yet. He slept in Odin's room for the first couple days, but, you know, I'm the calm, centered, big creature, and it's interesting to watch how I'm a source of comfort for all of these little beings that I take care of in my house. And when I was younger, I remember being sad because I felt like I couldn't make any real connections with all these animals, and I'd be jealous when my father would get those connections. But I understand now it's just because as a child, you don't even know what you want. Your energy is so hectic that it's like a turnoff almost when a creature is looking for some sort of foundation of comfort. And it makes me feel good to know that I can do that for the creatures that I take care of. And he's hilarious because he's taught me a lot about how you can approach an insane creature, because like he's always in hellion mode. I call him the hellion. Me and Odin were sitting around the other night, and I was like, inside of his head, he probably has just death metal going on constantly, like hardcore metal, like drums and rock and screams, like, and he's just running around all the time. And my parents call him four-wheel drive, and you have to watch him. You have to watch his body language. And he has his cute little ears that'll pin back against the back of his head, and those little muscles that constrict around the ears that will kind of pull him backwards. And it makes his face all clench up. And then, like, there's this look in his eyes, which, and this is 98% of the time that he's in the state where he's just insane. And he'll just attack any and everything. And so if you try to touch him at that time period, he'll attack you. And so I looked up on, I've been using ChatGPT, which, oh, I'm so unique now, but it is a great tool for, I mean, I've heard somebody say that, you know, these AI systems are not glorified search engines, but that's kind of how I use them, because instead of using Google, especially for simple things that aren't that important, well, I guess this was kind of important, but anyways, ChatGPT spit out that in order to get cats to not attack hands, it's really important to like deflect them and to redirect them. And so if most of the time he's trying to attack me, and if he even sits on my lap and he's just in the state where if I move my hand close to him, he's going to attack me, you know, I always have a toy close so that I can put the toy in front of him and redirect him so that he can't. And then hopefully over time, he'll associate hands with not attacking, and then he'll redirect himself. Whenever he's in that mode, he'll just go find a toy. Hopefully. But it's been cool, because as a big human, and if you're treating this life form as just a piece of pleasure, you know, instead of an end in itself, you know, we can objectify anything. And what is objectification mean? Like, objectification is when we turn something into an object, something. That word itself is an objective term because we're talking of something. However, everything is interdependent, is connected to itself. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that as soon as you are able to discriminate something and you see that it is connected to and needs all these other things that are around it in order to exist, as soon as you can see that, you start to become detached. Harder than it sounds to actually do, though. By far the most noticeably polluting way to objectify something is to objectify a person or your loved one. And the dating culture and the hookup culture, especially that I witnessed in my generation, that I found to be such a turnoff for me emotionally, is this use of other people as things, you know? And it could be agreed upon, it could be consensual, and that's fine. It never worked for me. You know, I tried to use a person, unfortunately. I hate saying that. It makes me feel disgusted. But I did it one time when I felt poorly, when I was sad, when I was younger, in my early 20s. And I knew this person liked me, and that if I said the right things, I felt pretty certain I could get pleasure, which this isn't odd. Arguably, it's not wrong. People do this as long as you're consenting, it's fine. But for me, I don't live that way. And after the act was done, I remember just feeling so nauseous and disgusted with myself. That was literally the last person I slept with. I've been celibate for years now. On purpose, I chose to be. And only recently have I started to consider putting myself out there and thinking about dating again. But a big part of why I burnt out on it so bad was because of this incident where I tried to use a person as a thing instead of a person, to treat them as a being instead of a thing. Now with the cat, arguably, a lot of people can look at their pets as the source of pleasure, and they are. It's very comforting. It makes me happy to make my animals happy, to pet my cat the way I know that she likes, or to play with Musky in a way that excites him, and to give him his food and to see how happy he is when he gets to eat dinner. You know, doing something to give instead of taking. Now, there's, of course, all these arguments that I've made in the past on what unconditional love is. And I think the biggest part of conditioning love is to need something from it. To use love and to use our relationships with our animals or with our children or with our significant other or with our coworkers or a stranger, to use these things as a patch to try to make us feel. Now, I've thought long and hard about what it means to love, and I wholeheartedly think that the basis of love is this giving aspect. I feel that inside all of our cores is this reserve of observation, of awareness, of disattachment, whereas attachment would be seeing things a specific way, and disattachment is looking at the connections and how something could look this way at a certain time, but in another way at a different time, depending on the vantage point. Relativity in science has broken the concept of what quantum mechanics may or may not even be. If it is that clear in science, how much more clear would it be with our own self-knowledge and experimentation and trying to learn and know who we are, which is arguably far more important than knowing how the world is. Now, another idea that's been coasting through my mind is from one of my favorite writers of all and speakers of all time, Jiddu Krishnamurti, which is one of my first episodes I ever did on this podcast almost 5 or 6 years ago, where I discussed one of Krishnamurti's books. And I'll probably read a little section of him here in a minute when I'm done talking about it. But basically, Krishnamurti was this Indian guy, and he wasn't strictly religious. His biggest mindset was this very anarchist, like the spiritual anarchist, where he looks at these organizations, he looks at teachings, he looks at where and how we adopt prescriptive ideas on how to be, which we are all looking for, because this idea of having this freedom of choice to choose who we are is intoxicatingly terrifying. And so it makes sense to go find an organization, to find a system that can say, hey, if you do it this way, if you follow us, we can make you happy and you'll belong. Keyword right there, massive italics, bold, underlined, belong. We all belong. We never don't. The only time that we decide we do not belong is when we isolate and we distinguish and we draw this sort of squiggly line box of, this is who I am. And often that's given to us. And so Krishnamurti was very much trying to get people to consider who and what is trying to put ideas into your head, and how to make our own prescriptions, which comes from standing outside of the thoughts, standing outside of the thought box. We have a sensation, we have an occurrence. Something happens in our life, and when that sensation blasts into existence, we sense it. That imprints an impression upon our mind. That mind reacts with a judgment, which can be desire or aversion. And from that desire and aversion comes anger and frustration and indecision. Now, I feel that Krishnamurti's biggest idea was that we have to know ourselves. And the only way to do that is to practice that awareness. But how do you do that without judging any and every action that comes, and any and everything that rains down from time infinitely? I'm not really quite sure, but I love the man's words. And so I'm going to go grab him, and then, that sounds weird. I'm going to go grab the book and then see what he has to say. Here we go. This is from his book, The First and Last Freedom, which is a collection of basically notated talks and question and answers, which is one of his biggest tropes, is these, like, people would be in the audience asking questions, or he would, you know, thought experiment if somebody was asking him these questions and then answering them. And he has this really Socratean sort of questiony way about approaching all of his discussions. And it's kind of redundant. Like he'll, like, at the end of a question, he'll be like, is it not? Is it not? You'll see that a lot. You'll hear it here in a second. But here we go. It is very important to discover which comes first. If the idea comes first, then action merely conforms to an idea. And therefore, it is no longer action, but imitation, compulsion, according to an idea. It is very important to realize this, because as our society is mostly constructed on the intellectual or verbal level, the idea comes first with all of us, and action follows. Action is then the handmaid of an idea. And the mere construction of ideas is obviously detrimental to action. Ideas breed further ideas. And when there is merely the breeding of ideas, there is antagonism. And society becomes top-heavy with the intellectual prowess of ideation. Our social structure is very intellectual. We are cultivating the intellect at the expense of every other factor of our being. And therefore, we are suffocated with ideas. Can ideas ever produce action? Or do ideas merely mold thought and therefore limit action? When action is compelled by an idea, action can never liberate man. It is extraordinarily important for us to understand this point. If an idea shapes action, then action can never bring about the solution to our miseries because, before it can be put into action, we have to first discover how the idea comes into being. The investigation of ideation, of the building up of ideas, whether of socialists, the capitalists, the communists, or of the various religions, is of the utmost importance, especially when our society is at the edge of a precipice, inviting another catastrophe, another exercise. Those who are really serious in their intention to discover the human solution to our many problems must first understand this process of ideation. What do we mean by an idea? How does an idea come into being? And can idea and action be brought together? Suppose I have an idea and action. Suppose I have an idea and I wish to carry it out. I seek a method of carrying it, and we speculate, waste our time and energies and quarreling over how the idea should be carried out. So it is really very important to find out how ideas come into being, and after discovering the truth of that, we can discuss the questions of action. Without discussing ideas, merely to find out how to act has no meaning. So this is kind of his method. He's speculating and he's sort of honing his focus. It's like you're zooming in on this pinpoint. And in this instance, it's this idea. Where does the idea come from? And as before, I gave you that little excerpt. He believes a lot of these ideas are given us directly by the society that we're born into, which is not our choice, which is not freedom. So these are some of the ideas that I had wandering through my mind as I walk through a beautiful pine forest this nice Sunday morning. So I appreciate you showing up, and I appreciate your time. I hope I gave you something to think about, and I hope that there's something that you feel you can relate to. Primarily, this is an attempt to be a source of presentness, a source of compassion, a source of awareness, or promoting awareness in your life, and by far a source pushing creativity and self-solidarity and self-knowledge, as Krishnamurti himself, I feel, spoke about. So I'm going to go grab Odin, and then we'll sign you off, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Hello, it's Osco and the Gingerbread Man.
I thought it was watermelons and turnips.
Okay, that's just weird.
Turnips.
Okay.
Turnips.
Okay.
Turnips.
Okay.
Where is my turnip?
Okay. But anyways, hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Gentlemans and gentlemelons. How's your day?
Good. I wonder how the people are listening right now's day.
They're all consuming their own turnips. It's fine.
Okay.
Don't think too much about it.
You've been saying it over and over again.
How's your forest this morning?
What do you mean forest? Oh,
I forgot to mention that the only mushrooms I found were the ones that Odin found. So he's my luck charm. He's going to be my bloodhound.
No. No.
Well, you got any good advice for anybody? Something you've been thinking about?
Well, not really.
Okay. Not really. Well, we appreciate you. We'll talk to you next week. Bye. Bye.